Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. After surfing the net, we found for you the most emailed, most viewed, most commented on, and mostling stories on the web. It's the most. I made up a word, I think. Mostling?
It's fine.
I think that's what you're allowed to do.
Oh, I'm allowed?
Yeah, on Fridays.
Nice. Caitlin Kenny, our producer. What's up, Caitlin?
All right. I have the most emails from BBC News, and the headline of the story is Legs Manual Wins Odd Title Prize. A self-help guide called If You Want Closure in Your Relationship, Start With Your Legs has been voted the oddest book title of the year. Yes. You heard what you just think you heard. This book is by an author named Big Boom, a self-described pimp and hustler who's also the author of the book How to Duck a Sucka, a guide to living a drama-free life. So clearly this man knows a thing or two about titles. The book beat out other competitors, including I Was Tortured by the Pygmy Love Queen, also Cheese Problem Solved. And there's been some really funny titles in the past. I just got to share a few of them with you. A selection of past winners includes American Bottom Archaeology, Reusing Old Graves, Highlights in the History of Concrete, The Joy of Sex Pocket Edition, Greek Rural Postmen and Their Cancellation Numbers, which is kind of strange.
I actually read that one. It was riveting.
It was dynamite.
Yeah.
And of course, the classic, The Big Book of Lesbian Horse Stories.
Horse Stories?
Yes. Yes. I think my personal favorite, though, is People Who Don't Know They're Dead, How They Attach Themselves to Unsuspecting Bystanders and What to Do About It. Sounds like an important book for everyone to have. So there you go.
Cheese problems.
Yeah, I was like, what kind of problem could there possibly be with cheese?
There's never a problem with cheese.
Yeah, seriously.
Dan Pashman.
I got a most emailed here from the Los Angeles Times. The suit that's turned the swim world on its head. This is a new version of a very controversial swimsuit by Speedo called the LZR Razor. And it is turning the world of competitive swimming on its head. In the past 6 weeks, with the new version of this special swimsuit, 14 world records have been set, 13 of them in the LZR Racer suit.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And there's a lot of controversy. Is this an unfair competitive advantage? This suit was designed with help from NASA and wind tunnels.
Wow. I'm thinking yes.
It takes 20 minutes to put it on.
20 minutes?
Right, because it's so incredibly tight.
Do you have to, like, lube yourself up before you slip into it?
It doesn't say that, but I'll look into that. But it's so incredibly tight that I can't even describe.
In Caitlin's mind, you do.
Right. It's so tight that I can't even describe what the picture of someone wearing this site looks like because I'd be violating FCC regulations. But there is no stitching in the suits, and the pieces are bonded ultrasonically. At a factory in Portugal, low-drag panels are embedded into the fabric to compress the swimmer's body. Some folks say it's an unfair advantage. Other folks say, hey, this happens in every sport. Guy makes an analogy. Well, they used to use bamboo poles for pole vaulting. Then they started using fiberglass poles. Right, baseball bats. Even more research, technology, etc. So
here you go. Here's a picture. I just Googled it for you, Rachel.
Whoa!
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, now.
Not much left to the imagination.
That's right.
Let's just put it that way.
I know everything I need to know about U.S. Olympian Michael Phelps. What can I say about that?
Too much. All right, Rachel, why don't you go? I think we have time.
Okay. Mine is the number one most emailed at the New York Times, and this is good news for runners and people who exercise in general, but specifically running. Everyone talks about the fact that when you go running or when you exercise a lot, you get endorphins that make you feel good, right? Or at least this is the myth. This has not actually been proven until now. All of a sudden, they've come up with research in Germany to prove that endorphins are real, and running in particular elicits this flood of endorphins into the brain. And they are directly linked with mood changes, and the more endorphins a runner's body pumps out, the greater the effect, and the better and happier you feel. And so it's all the more reason to go run.
All the more reason to join the running team my wife and I are putting together for the Concern USA Fun Run in Central Park. Raise some money for good cause, and our team's called the Pashmen Runneth.
So you are doing an on-the-air pitch.
Well, I'm talking to you guys here in the room. I've invited you guys all. Allie, you have an excuse, but the rest of you, no excuse.
You know, I
not
do
to
want to do that. You're right, you're right, you're
the
right.
Pashmen Runneth.
Plus, our endorphins are going to get pumping.
Yeah, runner's high.
Happy.
It's real.
Runner's high. Yeah, runner's
totally.
High is real.
Excellent. Hey, I'm going to finish up the most with most emailed from the Seattle Times. Man scammed by Craigslist ad. It's deja vu all over again. This guy in Oregon went away for a weekend. Two ads popped up on Craigslist on Saturday saying that the owner was forced to leave his home. Suddenly, all his belongings, help yourself. Just go on in. Including a horse, which was free for the taking. Now, the horse is an important part of the story because a woman who said, oh my gosh, I have to go get that horse. It's horrible. You know, this is really sad. This horse has been abandoned. I guess figured out who lived in the house and called the guy and said, hey, I'm going to take care of your horse. And he was like, what are you talking about?
Oh,
so he came home to find out that his home had been cleaned out.
Oh, man.
No word yet on who it is. Detectives have contacted Craigslist legal team to try to trace the ad. And then this is the saddest line in it. Meanwhile, the gentleman could not even relax on his porch swing. Someone took it.
Oh, man. Sounds like an angry ex-girlfriend to me. That's my bet.
Yes. Okay. We'll take
bets on that. I've seen an episode of The Closer much like that.
That would be the voice of Matt Martinez.
Hi. I have the number one most emailed story on NPR.org right now. It's a story by NPR science reporter Allison Aubrey, and it's about kids and cussing. Why kids and cussing? Kids and cussing is what it's about. Here's our piece, which begins by asking parents about the first time they heard their kids curse.
What I got back were lots of stories like Julia Gordon's. She was in her car, in a hurry, trying to park.
The parking lot was crazy. My daughter was in the back seat.
When a guy in another car stole a spot right out from under her, Gordon called out.
Oh man, that guy just totally Scrooged me. Except that I didn't say Scrooge.
It was the harsher version.
I said the slightly harsher version.
And a few minutes later came the little voice from the back seat parroting the same phrase.
I have to admit, I did laugh at first. And then I immediately stopped and told her, we don't say that word, and that mommy was very, very sorry for saying that word.
Young children major in the study of their parents, so it's no surprise that they mimic words and phrases, including the curse or slang that slips out.
That's just language learning. These words have no special status as taboo words. Learning that they're taboo words is a later step.
Paul Bloom is a psychologist at Yale. He says even very young children pick up on emotion and emphasis in their parents' voices, so they may get it that certain words are uttered in tense situations. But what's missing is judgment.
They're using words to communicate instinctively and automatically, and it takes a bit of know-how to step back and look at language not as something you automatically do, but something you could kind of contemplate and appreciate.
Bloom says a few years ago, his 6-year-old son Max came home from school one afternoon and asked in a quiet little voice, Dad, do you know what the worst swear word of all is?
And I was a bit nervous and I said, what? And he said, damn. And I was relieved and I said, so why is damn the worst swear word of all? And he said, well, I listen to my babysitter talk on the phone and she says the F word and the S word. She swears a lot, but she never says damn.
And at that moment.
Yep. And they pick it up from adults. They pick it up to some extent from movies and TV programs.
The Parents Television Council estimates that about once an hour, children watching Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, and other networks will hear mild curse words such as stupid, loser, and butt. The scope and frequency rise immeasurably with exposure to older programming. Bloom says as an experiment with his children, he and his wife tried their hand at creating their own family curse words.
So one of them was we would bang our foot and say something like, flip. And then whenever something bad happened, we'd scream flip as if it were an obscenity. And it was a total failure. Children looked at us like we were crazy.
And completely ignored their parents. The story gives one of Bloom's mentors, Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker, a chuckle.
Oh, dear. Yeah, because kids, first of all, their language is far more influenced by their peers than their parents anyway. That's why children of immigrants always end up with the accent of their peer group rather than their parents.
When it comes to choosing words, Pinker explains, we're forever coming up with new ways to say that something's good or bad. And with each generation, there's a little semantic inflation. So say you hear a song you really like. Someone of the Gen X generation may say it's awesome. A 20-something may say it's sweet, whereas a teen or tween of today may say it's bitchin'. If the song's lousy, they may say it sucks.
When I was a child, when you said that something sucked, everyone knew exactly what sexual act that referred to. I'm pretty sure that most kids who use it now have no idea.
It's just part of their common language, and frequent use over time has stripped away the original connotation. Pinker says the evolution of sucks is similar to the evolution of jerk a generation before.
it doesn't really matter where it actually comes from. What matters is what the perception is.
Jesse Scheidlauer is editor-at-large of the Oxford English Dictionary. He says evolving perceptions can create a disconnect between parents and kids. Suck may sound edgy and obnoxious to middle-aged ears, especially if we carry the baggage of its etymology.
It's kind of hard to explain why it should be bad, you know, why you shouldn't use this word, because that brings up a conversation you might not want to have right now.
Not everyone's on the same page about what constitutes offensive language, so parents are on their own to navigate the boundaries. Mom Sarah Pekkanen, who's got two boys, aged 6 and 8, says for her, a natural dividing line is attitude or intention.
I would actually be much quicker to jump on my kid for saying an unkind thing, you know, even if he used perfect language to do so, than I would be to jump on my kid for maybe using a borderline word, like it sucks.
A clear message like this about respect and kindness may be more fruitful than trying to police every word. As pediatrician Monica Walters points out, by the time kids enter the teen world, cursing is almost a rite of passage.
It's hard sometimes, but I think as parents, you worry that, oh my God, they're going to grow up to be adults that are like vagrants and a menace to society.
When parents like this come to see her or pull her aside after an office appointment, worried about vulgar words they spotted in their teens' text messages, she asks them to remember how they talked at 15. Walter says if offensive language is part of a pattern of aggressive behavior, there's a problem. But in most cases, it's just the way teens salt their language.
Obscenity is a sure ticket into adulthood.
Or at least perceiving that you sound older. Paul Bloom says there's also more emotional resonance. He says he knows he can't control the words his children use with their friends, and he says that's the way it should be. It's part of growing up.
Another part of growing up, though, is knowing how to talk to adults and knowing how to talk in formal situations. So what we'd like our children to end up knowing is what these words are, but when it's appropriate to use them.
At the moment, Bloom says his son is taken to the term crap damn. Appropriate for formal situations or with adults? Not so much. It seems teaching good judgment is not a one-time event. It's a process.
That's NPR's Allison Aubrey reporting. That story is the most emailed at npr.org right now. And that is the most, folks. These stories and more on our website, npr.org/Bryant Park.